You've got to keep in mind that I'm only 16. I'm skinny. And there's Big Dave Keller. He asked me, whose are those? I cracked.
Welcome to the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs. Episode 1. Hi, I'm Josh Durham.
And I'm Ashley Pace.
We all wonder about the various people who we crossed paths with decades ago, like a classmate, a kid that lived in our neighborhood, or even an old flame. We all do it. With Facebook and Google, it can be pretty easy to figure out whatever happened to them. But even then, most times, we never reach out to them. So we're left to wonder, do they remember us? And do they remember any of the events that have stood out in our minds for so long?
For us, it's the same with the 1990 Burlington Indians, and one player in particular, Frank Monastero.
You can Google Frank and see what the rest of his days after Burlington were like.
But you won't find anything about what happened in a dugout corridor in Burlington, North Carolina. That part of his story has remained untold for 30 years. And you won't find anything about whether I cost him his professional baseball career.
If you do Google Frank Monastero and go deep into your search results, you'll find that he was a bit of a mystery when he came to Burlington. At least so far as his name was concerned, his baseball card for the 1990 Burlington Indians has his last name wrong. It has it as Monastro, leaving out an E.
And in the local paper season preview on June 25th, 1990, it has his name as Monastreo, mixing up the E and the R, and other places has it with an S on the end.
They did get it right in the team picture, which they shot at Holly Hill Mall. You can see that on our Facebook page. Just search for Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs. Ashley, tell me what you remember about Frank Monastero.
Let's see, Frank. He was a good guy, always smiling, kind of always joking around, you know, kind of always treated us like we were one of the, you know, one of the team. Never treated us poorly, you know, because we just worked for the team. We weren't on the team. He wasn't very tall. I remember that. Just an all-around nice guy.
Frank Monastero was born on November 22, 1968, on the fifth anniversary of JFK's assassination. He was from Norristown, Pennsylvania, and in 1990, when he was 21 years old, he was drafted by the Cleveland Indians out of Westchester University in Pennsylvania. He was a middle infielder, and he was sent to Burlington, North Carolina to begin his professional career. I always identified with Frank because I'd played second base for most of my youth baseball career. I'm partial to middle infielders.
Now, Frank was taken late in the draft. He was actually Cleveland's last pick that year, in the 59th round. He was the 1,374th overall pick in the draft. He definitely had some long odds to make it to the majors, but it wasn't really impossible. In 1988, there was a guy named Mike Piazza who was taken even later than that. Piazza made it to the Hall of Fame.
But even if Frank Monastero didn't make it all the way to the big leagues, it certainly wouldn't be unheard of to at least move up a little bit in the minor leagues, to play several seasons there before calling it quits. But 1990 was Frank's only season of professional baseball.
When we think about Frank Monastero, we can't help but think of Archibald Moonlight Graham. Baseball fans know his story. Graham toiled away in the minor leagues, and in 1905 he was called up to the majors. He played one inning in the field, but nothing was ever hit his way. The game ended before he got to bat, and he was sent back down to the minor leagues after the game. That one appearance in the field turned out to be his only appearance in the big leagues.
In the movie Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner, Ray Kinsella, played by Costner, is able to track Moonlight Graham down. Graham's an old man, he became a doctor, but through some sort of baseball magic, he becomes young again. He plays on the field that Ray built in the middle of his cornfield, and he's able to hit and play with the greatest players of all time.
Yeah, but then Ray's annoying brother-in-law comes to pressure Ray and his wife into selling the farm. Apparently, it wasn't a great idea to plow through your cash crop to build a baseball field. The bank is going to foreclose, and Ray is going to lose everything. That's when James Earl Jones delivers his passionate "People Will Come" speech, and Ray says they're not selling. The brother-in-law can't stand all this. He gets pretty fired up. He causes Ray's daughter to fall off the top bleacher, and she goes into some kind of distress. Something is happening to her, and Moonlight Graham, the doctor, notices.
At that point, the young Graham has to make a choice. Does he keep playing ball for all eternity with the greatest players to have ever lived, to live his dream forever? Or does he give it all up to be a doctor again so he can save the little girl's life? Those who know the movie know that he chooses the latter. He's transformed from the young ball player into the elder doctor. He gives the girl a good whack on the back and saves her life. Turns out she'd been choking on a hot dog. And Moonlight Graham's dream of playing in the pros is gone forever because of a hot dog. Ashley, does that hit a little close to home?
I'm not going to lie. It does a little bit.
We're getting ahead of ourselves, though. You've heard a little bit about Frank Monastero, and you'll certainly hear more about him as the podcast goes on. But we really need to introduce you to where everything happened.
Burlington, North Carolina, and Burlington Athletic Stadium. It's a great place for baseball. Here's pitcher Alan Embry, who spent more than 15 years in the majors. He was the Cleveland Indians' fifth pick in the 1989 draft, but he was recovering from a shoulder injury in high school, so he didn't come to Burlington until 1990. By the way, he says the injury probably cost him a spot as a first-round pick. But here's what he had to say about his time in Burlington in the summer of 1990.
I remember the whole atmosphere. It was a great first experience for me. The people were awesome. The people that worked there were great. From the time the trip picked me up to the time that I left, I had a great experience. It was just nice to have that sort of feeling my first time away from home.
That's my brother, Trip Durham, he's talking about. You'll hear more about him later. And here's pitcher Tony Tillman, taken in the 27th round in 1989. 1990 was his second season in Burlington.
The city of Burlington was very supportive of the team. You know, you would go in different restaurants, they might not let you buy lunch. Always had a good crowd, and they were always behind the Indians in Burlington, a very supportive town.
Burlington is in North Carolina's Piedmont region, which is the middle section of the state. Today, there are about 50,000 residents there. It's a town once that was known as company shops in the 1800s for the village and repair shops that supported a booming rail industry. But when the railway shifted a lot of its operations elsewhere in the state in the late 1800s, the town was forced to adopt a new name, and Burlington it was. A great and booming textile industry popped up. For those who are curious, there's no connection to Burlington Coat Factory. That was born up north.
And right on the edge of the city sits Burlington Athletic Stadium. You can actually see it in the movie Bull Durham. At 46 minutes and 47 seconds, the Bulls are at the beginning of a road trip. Max Papkin, the clown prince of baseball, is doing a bit in the stands. Pause the movie right there and look at the Marlboro Man sign in the outfield. Two signs to the left is a white sign with red letters. It's Chip Durham's TV and Appliance. That was my dad's store.
At 47 minutes and 45 seconds, the Bulls pull into War Memorial Stadium in Greensboro. The movie then cuts to Nuke LaLoosh. He's sitting in the bullpen, and he tucks a pair of women's undergarments into his jacket pocket. There, in the background, is Burlington Athletic Stadium.
And at the 1 hour and 4 minute mark, when the Bulls go on a winning streak in June and July, and Crash Davis starts hitting home runs on the way to a league record, he hits a home run at Burlington Athletic Stadium. You can see my dad's billboard there, too. Bull Durham came out in 1988, and Burlington Athletic Stadium was pretty new then, even though it had been there since the 50s. Here's Miles Wolf, who brought baseball to Burlington in 1986. Miles was the one who brought the Bulls back to Durham in 1980. He's one of the biggest names in minor league baseball.
The ballpark had originally been located in Danville, Virginia. And when Danville lost the team in their team in 1958, the city of Burlington bought the ballpark, moved for $5,000, the entire ballpark, moved it piece by piece to Burlington, set it up, and they had a nice stadium.
But when the Burlington Rangers finished a successful 1972 season, they packed their things and left Burlington forever. By that time, the stadium was not good at all. Here's Miles Wolf again.
Burlington lost their team, and it had the reputation as the worst ballpark in minor league baseball. The lights were awful. The city hadn't kept it up. The playing field was awful. And nobody thought baseball would come back. But the ballpark was wood, so when we got there in the early 80s, the grandstand was rotted, the wood, the lights were still awful. It just wasn't a good facility.
That was when I discovered the stadium. In the early 80s, when I was in elementary school, the YMCA hosted a flag football league there. We played our games in the outfield grass, far away from the wooden grandstand. But after our games, when our parents enjoyed the last minutes of adult conversation, we couldn't help but explore. There was a concrete structure at the bottom of the grandstand. It was about a story high, and the dugouts were part of it. It ran from about halfway down the first baseline, behind home plate, and then about halfway down the third baseline. We'd climb on top of the dugouts and even into the wooden grandstand. We didn't go too far up that, though, because it was crumbling and we were all scared the whole thing might collapse.
And it's not the fall that would kill you, but the sudden stop at the end.
That's right. And then we'd go into the dugouts and up the ramp into a concrete corridor that ran underneath the grandstand. I loved that stadium, even in its rundown condition.
So how did baseball come back to Burlington in that stadium? Again, here's Miles Wolf.
The Carolina League had been struggling. They got down as few as four clubs, then six. The Bulls came in, but we were always looking for new cities.
At this point, we should probably explain the minor league system. Think of a beginning league called A-ball, then high A-ball. Then there's double A and then triple A, then the major leagues. The Carolina League is high A-ball now, with teams like the Carolina Mudcats and the Winston-Salem Dash. Then there's the South Atlantic League, or the Sally League. It's A-ball as well. Teams like the Asheville Tourists and the Greensboro Grasshoppers are in that league.
You know, having grown up in Greensboro, I'd come over to Burlington for games, loved the Burlington fans, or hated them because they were so vocal and loyal, but knew the ballpark was there. And as I say, the Carolina League was hopefully expanding and we needed cities. And I didn't know anybody in Burlington, but I did know Jack McKeon.
Jack McKeon, also known as Trader Jack. He lived in Elon College right next door to Burlington. He'd been a major league manager and even general manager. When McKeon was named general manager of the Padres in 1980, he tried rebuilding that team through a flurry of trades, which earned him the nickname of Trader Jack. McKeon would later win a World Series as manager of the Florida Marlins in 2003. But back to the 80s and Miles Wolf.
And I called Jack and said, Jack, who should I call in Burlington to see about bringing baseball back? And he mentioned the mayor pro tem, Ken Ketchum, might really be interested. And I met with the mayor pro tem, and it was gung-ho.
Now I have to interrupt. His reference to Mr. Ketchum caught me completely off guard. From 1980 to 1984, I lived on Edgewood Avenue in Burlington, and not far from our house was the most glorious set of woods I've ever known. There were amazing bike trails all through the woods, there were jumps and forts, and they were just amazing. There were probably a dozen of us in the neighborhood who played in those woods nearly every day. But then one day, we all caught wind that the woods were going to be cut down and the whole area was going to be developed into a shopping center. We were outraged. And the kids in the neighborhood got together and we started a petition. We went door to door collecting signatures and we presented them to Mr. Ketchum. who said there was nothing he could do. I've never forgiven him for that in all this time. But in doing this podcast, I learned from Miles Wolf that Mr. Ketchum did do some good, too. I guess I do forgive him after all. Here's Miles Wolf again.
The Carolina League, there wasn't a team ready to go, but the South Atlantic League was. But then Greensboro blocked it. They had territorial rights on it. So the Braves were going to move to Burlington, but the Greensboro team blocked it. So the Appalachian League sort of was out there.
Okay, remember how we talked about the different levels of the minors? The Appalachian League is down there at the very bottom. It's called Rookie League.
We heard, you know, they were looking for some cities, but originally they didn't want to move out of the core Appalachian League area in the mountains. But there was a city Cleveland Indians were going to, but the city said, we'd love to have you, but we don't want any black ball players.
You heard that right. He said there was a city that could have gotten a new team, but they said they didn't want any black ball players. I asked Miles about that, and he said that that city explained they didn't have any housing for them. Never mind that the Civil Rights Act had been established law for nearly two decades at that point. I asked him whether the league tried to change that city's mind, and he said there was really no point in even trying. If they felt that way, it was best to find another city. And that city's loss was Burlington's gain.
And so that sort of turned things around, and the Indians came to us, and we said, well, we'll get Burlington ready. By then, the mayor pro tem, Ketchum, was the mayor. He was able to get some funds from the state. He worked hard. And by the time opening day in 86 happened, the ballpark was really nice. They put in new lights, new poles. They'd redone the grandstand in aluminum, had fixed up the clubhouses. So, you know, the guts of the stadium was good. It just hadn't been kept up. And once the city committed to it, it became a nice little minor league ballpark.
The guts that Miles mentioned, that was the cinder block structure we described. It's where the locker rooms were, the coaches' offices, and the dugouts. And there was a corridor that ran all the way through it from end to end. That corridor was where everything went down. And inside the manager's office, well, that's where Frank Monastero was put on trial, and I was the main witness. Me, at 16 years old. It was the summer of 1990.
1990. George H.W. Bush was in the White House. The Cold War was over, and Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev took a celebratory lap through the United States. Baseball stories in the sports pages were filled with the names of Ripken, Sandberg, Griffey, Boggs, and Mattingly.
And in June of 1990, Burlington was getting ready for its fifth season of Indians baseball.
Ashley and I were best friends that summer. I had just graduated high school.
And I was a rising high school senior.
And that summer, we needed jobs. Enter my older brother, Tripp. He'd been with the team since it started in 1986. He started out in the clubhouse washing uniforms late into the night. And in the following years, he moved up a little bit in the organization, becoming a front office employee. He got me the job as a camera person filming the Indians pitchers and batters for the Indians coaching staff. I made $15 a game.
And I got a job as the bat boy. I made $10 a game.
Ashley, what all does being a bat boy entail?
Well, it really means during the game, you know, if a player gets on base, you've got to go out and get their bat, bring it back to the dugout, kind of keep the equipment straight. When the umpires need more baseballs, you've got to take those out to them. But mainly, it's keeping the equipment straight.
What you need to know about jobs in the minor leagues is that job descriptions are pretty fluid. Here's John Brown, who was returning to the Indians for his second year as general manager in his early 20s. As general manager, he was responsible for hiring staff, ticketing, sponsorships, concessions, and merchandise sales. You know, the business of baseball. but there was a whole lot more.
One of the things that I always said about my experiences in minor league baseball was one of the great experiences of it is literally you got to do hands-on on virtually every aspect. You know, for example, it was very common for us to, if there was rain on the horizon, everybody who was around threw a pair of shorts and old t-shirt on and ran out to the field and pulled the tarp on the field. And, you know, from there, we might go in and get cleaned up. And then we were in the concession stands getting things ready for that night.
And here's Dave Burke, who was a college intern for the team that summer, describing the glamorous life of working in the minors and the many hats that one wears there.
Obviously, working in baseball, you work in godly hours. So we were working, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week. I was getting paid $300. I was living on the second floor of a brick house without any air conditioning. And so I dropped 20 pounds that summer without even blinking an eye and loved every minute of it, though. I was helping out Alex Mobley on the grounds crew, but I was also helping out with the merchandise, the food and beverage. You know, at the time, I was helping out with the team cleaning, you know, the cleaning of the uniforms and all that stuff.
We did a lot of that stuff, too. Josh and I helped prep the field. We pulled the tarp when it rained. We got the field ready after rain delays. We even gave players rides home after the games.
So now you have a good sense of the when and the where. It's time that we introduce you to the judge, jury, and executioner, manager Dave Keller.
Dave was a great guy, and you know he was kind of a mild-mannered guy in some ways, the big guy.
That was general manager John Brown again.
And here's Tony Tillman again. He describes Coach Keller's size a little more descriptive.
Called Dave King Tone.
He was a big dude.
Coach Keller didn't play around. He was a big guy. People call him Oso, which is Spanish for bear. He's a member of the University of Northern Colorado Hall of Fame for baseball and basketball. He'd played in the Reds minor league system for a few years, and when he hung his spikes up for their Tampa team in 1984, he came back as a coach the next year. He got his first managerial job in 1987 in Montana for the first team that he actually played for in the minors.
We thought he was so old in the summer of 1990, but in doing our research for this podcast, we found out that he was only 30 that season.
I honestly was shocked to find that out.
We mentioned that Coach Keller didn't play around. He probably had a lot of rules that he was very serious about, but the one we knew the most was this.
They told us they didn't want a bunch of food in the clubhouse. So I told them that they were not allowed to run anybody to the concession stand to get hot dogs or nachos or any of that stuff. Like sometimes I'd walk back through the clubhouse and there'd be guys standing in line because right there at the end of the bleachers right there was a concession stand through that little tunnel. And there'd be guys standing in line in their uniform waiting to eat. And that was a huge no-no at the time.
And he enforced that rule with fines. And these fines hurt. Most of the players back then were making somewhere between $800 and $1,200 per month during essentially a three-month season.
Hot dogs were $25. I know somebody, I caught somebody that ended up, they had three hot dogs there, and I'd asked them if they were all for them, and they said, yeah. And I said, okay. You better enjoy those hot dogs because they just cost you $75. And they were like, what? I said, yeah, man. I'd eat them slow, man, to make sure they're really good.
And that brings us to the matter at hand.
Remember how we said that job descriptions in the minors were flexible? Well, one of my informal duties as a bat boy was to be a food runner. Players often asked me to get food for them before a game. Early on in the season, I refused. I played by the rules. But as the season went on and I got to know the players better, well, I caved.
So what happened?
I was getting Frank some hot dogs before the game, and I'm walking back through that corridor, and Keller pops out from nowhere. You've got to keep in mind that I'm only 16. I'm skinny. Darryl Whitmore, he's one of the guys who made it all the way to the majors. He's on that team. And he said I was so skinny I could hula hoop with a Cheerio. And there's Big Dave Keller. He asked me, whose are those? I cracked. I said they were Frank's.
Now, before you think that the fine might have been the end of it, there's more. As we remember the story, Frank denied the charge.
And I was called into Coach Keller's office to testify.
So here's why we've wondered about all of this for 3 decades.
Not long after that whole episode, I went to the beach with family, and when I came back, Frank was gone. Never seen or heard from him since.
You'll hear about all of that and more on the next episodes of the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs.
Your history has changed your mind.
Our music is courtesy of the band Cabinet. Find them online at cabinetmusic.com.
You finally broke down and tried to let yourself go.
You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram at Cabinet Music. Check our Facebook page for links and more information. Search Facebook for the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs to find our page.